ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Selena Green bringing you The Country Hour again today. Well, Australia, we're told, is now on a La Nina watch. What does that actually mean? We'll find out in a moment. And have you ever gotten behind the wheel of a vehicle when you were just bone tired? Well, we're repeatedly told that fatigue is one of the biggest killers on our roads. When you're tired and driving heavy machinery or a large truck, the potential for disaster increases.
Sometimes it's around, you know, drivers are pre-planning their journey and not quite taking into account delays, or sometimes maybe just pushing a little bit further than they should to try and meet a deadline or to try and get to the destination. You know, for the sake of saving a few minutes, it's not worth your life or the life of someone else on the road.
Absolutely not. That's why there's a new campaign starting today focusing on fatigue in the trucking industry, and you're going to hear more about that shortly. As always, I'm keen to hear from you at any time throughout the program. My talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line 0467 922 891. But first today, the Bureau of Meteorology has put Australia on a La Nina watch, but it doesn't mean we will definitely move to La Nina weather patterns. The six wettest winter-spring periods on record for eastern Australia have occurred during La Nina years, according to the Bureau, and they've caused billions of dollars in damage from flooding and extreme rain. But Carl Braganza, the National Manager of Climate Services at the Bureau of Meteorology, well, he told Michael Condon that it's just a warning and it's still too early to call La Nina yet.
Basically, our early alerting system for El Nino and La Nina events, and at this stage in the ENSO cycle, so the El Nino Southern Oscillation, we sometimes go to a watch, which really means that our indicators in the Pacific are indicating that, you know, the early signs of an event developing are there. It should be emphasised that it is early days, though, and we're talking about an event potentially developing later in the year. It's also probably worth pointing out that this system of El Nino and La Nina alerting really goes back to the days when we used these climate influences as the major source of predictability for Australian rainfall and temperature. So it is in some ways a bit of a legacy system. Some people still find this information useful as a very early warning for what might occur later in the year. But we would like to emphasise these days that we would prefer people to look at the actual long-range three-month forecast for rainfall and temperature, and that's another product that we issue. So, yeah, we're going to La Nina watch, but I'm sort of here to say please have a look at our actual forecast for rainfall and temperature for the next 3 months.
Well, what is that saying then for the next three months?
So for the next 3 months now, I guess to start that story, we've had some dry conditions across the south, particularly associated with a lack of rainfall from the westerly, so cold fronts and cut-off lows that typically affect the westward-facing parts of Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia and Western Australia. Forecasts for the next 3 months showing about even for above and below median rainfall. So what does that mean? It means that we don't have anything out there really favouring either wet or dry conditions. So, you know, hopefully they'll at least see something more like their average rainfall over the next 3 months. Just further north of that, particularly in inland WA and inland South Australia, the odds are favouring above average rainfall over the next 3 months, and into New South Wales as well. So while that southern fringe still isn't looking at, you know, high chances of above average rainfall, it isn't saying that it should be too dry.
Yeah, and that would be pleasing for people in South Australia and WA who are feeling it's very dry and they would like some rain to kick off their cropping season.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the pattern for the long-range forecast for the next 3 months, it's still sort of suggesting that compared to the rest of the country, we're not expecting a large amount of rainfall from those westerly systems. But fingers crossed we do get some rainfall through that region.
And the other issue, I guess, is when you talk about La Nina watch, it doesn't guarantee we're going to see wetter than usual conditions like we had when we had those three La Ninas in a row.
It doesn't. I think the main message here is even the sequence of El Nino events that we've seen, three La Ninas, then an El Nino, and then this going to La Nina watch, it's quite unusual. We've got very warm ocean temperatures. And so that's really telling us that I think history is less of a guide than it once was to these things. And it's why we're putting more of our eggs in the basket of the climate model, weather model that we run out for the next 3 months, because we think relying on our memory of past events is probably not going to give us the best steer at the moment.
So is that climate change?
In terms of the ocean warming, that is climate change. So the oceans have been in record warm territory since early last year, and they haven't really backed off. And since we've got these large climate influences that are based on what happens in the oceans to our west and east, that ocean warming is making a difference to the comparisons with the past, where the oceans were a bit cooler.
And is it going to be warmer? Is it going to be colder? What's going to happen?
Look, across Australia, we're seeing high chances of having above average temperatures over the next 3 months. And that's consistent with forecasts over the last year or so. Also consistent with that, just warmer oceans around Australia and globally.
Is that climate change too?
Oh, look, over the next 3 months, climate change, the whole climate system has warmed by between one and one and a half degrees at the moment. So that's affecting kind of every weather system, so including our seasonal forecasts. It's certainly making it more likely that we have warmer than average forecasts rather than cooler than average forecasts. But over the next 3 months, it's really also just those proximate causes that are driving climate.
And I guess with La Nina watch, I mean, that makes some farmers pretty happy because they like it when it's wet. But then again, there's others, you know, in those last three events, last three La Nina concurrents, we saw a lot of flooding, we saw a lot of damage, we saw floods in Lismore. So I guess people get a bit nervous when we talk La Nina now.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's one reason that we're looking at this service and whether it's still, you know, serving the information needs that we want to put out. The most common state for ENSO after an El Niño event is neutral conditions. There's some months to go to see if La Niña does develop. And it's only one influence on Australia. We do have a range of other influences coming from our west and the south, for example. So, yeah, let's see how this one develops. Some people really like a long planning horizon, and this information goes into the mix of the things that they consider. But yeah, we would ask people to really treat that with caution at the moment.
Oh, that's the thing that goes into the mix, but don't rely on it. Is that what you're saying? So, you know, think about it and have it in the back of the mind, but don't, as you say, you know, don't count on it. Don't bet the house on it.
Yeah, look, the thing about forecasting, and it's something everyone can understand, as you get closer to the event, your forecasts become more accurate. And the further out you get, there's just so many things that can happen in the climate system that, you know, make that forecast much more uncertain. So I guess keep watching the forecasts, keep getting the information that you want out of them. But yeah, keep a close eye on them.
Because quite often we get a lot of texts in from farmers that are giving the Bureau a bit of stick about their long range forecast too. So I suppose what you're saying there is that, you know, you still need to be cautious.
Yeah, we do. I mean, with the long range forecast, what we're basically trying to do is do something that's more accurate and more useful for those that use them than just relying on historical averages. So if we didn't have a forecast, we'd say, well, what's the average rainfall for, you know, June for this location? And we'll use that as a guide. The modern models that we run do better than that. They're actually providing that kind of additional intelligence that gives you something beyond your just historical guidance. If you follow them for 10 years, you'll come out in front, but we can't expect every year that the forecast is going to do well at 3 months out, for example. But yeah, followed suitably and used suitably, we think they provide really good information.
That is Carl Braganza there. He's the National Manager of Climate Services at the Bureau of Meteorology, and he was speaking to Michael Condon. La Niña was associated with the floods, were told in 1955, 1988, 1998 and 2010 as well. It's just going on 14 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green. Today, the National Heavy Vehicle Regulator has launched an operation that aims to remind truck drivers not to drive while fatigued. It's a South Australian-based operation. It'll run for a week, and drivers will be checked from the Western Australian border to Port Augusta. National Heavy Vehicle Regulator Chief Operations Officer Paul Salvati says that stretch of road is a long one for drivers, and they want to make sure that everyone's doing the right thing.
We've launched this operation to try and prevent fatigue-related events from happening on our roads. So what we're seeing is obviously fatigue is one of the big killers and one of the big safety risks on our roads. So by getting out there in force and talking to drivers and answering their questions and checking to make sure they're not driving fatigued, that's one of the ways in which we can keep road users safe.
Has there been a lot of fatigue-related breaches by truck drivers?
Less every year, Brooke. So what we're seeing is quite a few years ago, fatigue was a lot more prevalent than it is today. I think as drivers become more professional, operations become more professional, and people become aware of the rules around driving hours, we're seeing less and less fatigue-related events. But having said that, even one dip on our roads is too many.
How do you check if a driver is fatigued, or does it simply come down to if they're filling out their logbook correctly?
It's a bit of both, Brooke. The work diary is a fairly broad instrument where we can actually see how many hours they've been driving for, and the law sets out how long you can drive for. But at the same time, we train our officers to look for other signs of fatigue when they're talking to a driver, and that's everything from the really obvious ones around slurring, inability to concentrate, but also more subtle signs as well, such as struggling to keep your eyes open or even just struggling to answer questions and things like that.
Is there a way, though, that if, you know, if their work diaries are correct and you might look at them and they say, oh, you know, they look a bit tired, how can you sort of say to them, you can't keep driving, we think you are fatigued?
The law does allow our staff on the road the powers to do that, Brooke. So even if the work diary is showing that they've actually got more hours to drive, if our staff at the side road believe that they are too fatigued to drive, we can actually ground the vehicle and ground that driver and put in place a mandatory rest break for that driver just to keep themselves and other drivers safe.
Now, this operation, Paul, is looking from the WA border to Port Augusta. So why not the whole state, or is this an area that is most concentrated?
Good question, Brooke. We find different safety risks in different parts of the state. So in that particular part of the state, because of the distance from some of those long-haul drivers are travelling, we're finding fatigue is a bigger issue in that area, whereas if we're looking more around the Adelaide area or around, let's say, Berry, we'd see different kinds of safety risks.
And so fatigue is obviously one, like you said, it's a long strip of road with maybe not as many facilities for drivers to pull over?
It is a long strip of road, Brooke. There are facilities there, but sometimes it's around, you know, drivers are pre-planning their journey and not quite taking into account delays, or sometimes maybe just pushing a little bit further than they should to try and meet a deadline or to try and get, you know, get to the destination.
Is this about handing out fines and enforcing this, or is this also looking at educating drivers as well about what they can do to manage fatigue?
Brooke, we see our role as education as much as enforcement. We need to make sure the drivers understand how to manage their fatigue, how to fill their work diary. But, Brooke, if someone has a history of driving tired or if someone is intentionally doing the wrong thing, we absolutely take enforcement action to keep them and other users safe.
And obviously, Paul, there's been lives lost again this year in crashes involving heavy vehicles. Is this tied in with those incidents as well, or is this a campaign that you would look at doing moving forward more often?
Brooke, I'll start by saying that those crashes we've seen recently on the air, they're absolute tragedies, and our condolences go out to all those impacted. We do have regular fatigue campaigns across the year, but off the back of what we've seen happening recently, we do want to just lift our presence in that area just to remind drivers to drive safe, to not drive fatigued, and to make sure that no one's been put at risk when they're driving on our roads.
Do truck drivers find that sometimes there's pressure from their employer to drive while fatigued to get a job done?
Unfortunately, Brooke, we still hear that there is pressure being put on drivers to drive when they're tired and drive longer hours to get the job done. And we strongly encourage any driver who feels pressured by their employer to drive when they're fatigued to call our confidential reporting hotline on 1800 931 785.
And what can happen from there?
Every single call to the hotline gets analysed, and where we actually identify that there's a risk which we can quantify or where we believe has some depth to it, we can actually do an investigation on that employer to identify if they actually are forcing their drivers to drive fatigued or pressuring their drivers to drive fatigued. And then there's a range of penalties in the heavy vehicle national law, including jail sentences, where we find employees actually are doing that.
And just finally, Paul, what are some of those, those proactive measures that drivers can take to mitigate that risk of fatigue on the roads before they head off on their journeys?
Good question, Brooke. Some of the proactive measures people can take, they can make sure they're well rested before they go on their journey. So if they've got a new baby or they've got some reason they haven't had a good rest, make sure they tell their boss, pre-plan their journey, pre-plan their rest stops, recognising themselves, the signs of fatigue. People know when they're fatigued. We say take frequent rest breaks, make sure you understand your work diary requirements, and also from a longer-term perspective, understand how your diet and lifestyle choices actually can impact your fatigue as well.
What would be your message to those, as this operation kicks off, as it's launched by the NHVR, for those that are travelling in a truck right now?
Look, my message to those travelling in a truck is just look after yourself, look after your own safety. you know, for the sake of saving a few minutes, it's not worth your life or the life of someone else on the road.
Good advice, not just for truck drivers, but each and every one of us. That is the Chief Operations Officer with the National Heavy Vehicle Regulator, Paul Silvati there, and he was speaking to Brooke Neindorf.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, a bit of an update on what's going on with the federal government's proposed biosecurity levy bill. And the bill has disappeared from the Senate's planned business, where it had been scheduled for debate. Now, on Tuesday evening, Green Senator Peter Whish-Wilson told the ABC the party would not be supporting the bill, which passed the lower house in March. Now, he said the levy amounted to a tax on farmers, which the Greens said was unfair. Now, that bill aims to raise $1 billion for biosecurity measures. Importers would have contributed 48%, taxpayers 44% of the funding pool, and farmers were asked to stump up $50 million. Well, this morning the ABC asked the Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt's office if the bill had been withdrawn, and we received this statement in response, which I'll read. It says, "With importers, taxpayers and travellers now contributing over $750 million to protect our agriculture industry from biosecurity threats, it's a shame the industry doesn't see the need to contribute around 5% of that. In saying no to this reform, the opposition and Greens political party are again expecting Australian taxpayers to reach into their pockets to pay more instead of an industry contribution. The government remains committed to sustainably funded security system, something the ag sector has called for years." And the statement from Murray Watt's office wraps up by saying, "We will continue to consider all options to ensure we maximise available funding for biosecurity through a broad-based funding model that includes contributions from risk creators, taxpayers and systems beneficiaries." Now, without the support of the Greens on the crossbench, the bill can't pass the Senate. The government would be short the votes it needs to get the legislation passed. And that is the latest on that rather controversial proposed biosecurity levy. Another update for you today, and that is on the National Centre for Farmer Health, which is based in Western Victoria. And we're told today that the Victorian government has backflipped on a decision to cut funding from that National Centre for Farmer Health. It was confirmed by the centre that its base $900,000 per year in funding was cut in the Victorian budget, which came out last week. But after that story was aired on the Country Hour and ABC Radio, the Victorian government now says it's found the money for one more year from other sources. The chair of the National Centre for Farmer Health, Greg Walcott, says it's great news and the government should be commended for changing its mind. The time is 22 minutes past 12. It is time to go to the Mount Compass Market Reports, and Elsie Adamo has them for you today. Good afternoon, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. Quality was again extremely mixed as agents offered 859 live weight and open auction cattle. The majority of the yarding comprised 222 cows, 232 heifers and 361 steers. Score 2 cattle were present in large numbers in all categories and sold mostly firm on the most recent sale. The better conditioned cattle on offer improved in value by 10 to 30 cents per kilogram under good competition from the usual trade and processor buyers, while feeder and restocker competition saw the best of the suitable cattle in these classes rise by a similar amount. A good selection of cows of all weights and grades also recorded a lift of 10 to 15 cents. Veal steers sold from 180 to 327 cents, as veal heifers ranged from 167 to 295 cents per kilogram. Yearling steers ranged from 139 cents to 323 cents, as yearling heifers sold from 123 to 305 cents per kilogram. Beef bred manufacturing steers sold from 265 to 285 cents, with dairy breed selling from 170 to 235 cents per kilogram. Beef bred grown steers ranged from 219 to 321 cents, as dairy types sold from 193 to 200 cents per kilogram, with grown heifers selling from 161 to 299 cents per kilogram. Light beef cows sold from 60 to 160 cents, with dairy types selling 120 cents per kilogram. Medium beef cows made from a low of 50 cents to a top of 227 cents, as dairy types sold from 70 to 165 cents per kilogram. Heavy beef cows range from 120 to 282 cents, as dairy breeds sold from 80 to 200 cents per kilogram. Bull sold from 140 to 230 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Oh, mornings! Will Anderson, you've been targeted.
It's too early for advertising. Skip.
The adverts are in your home.
Spam on my fridge now? No. Unsubscribe.
You're being influenced.
I don't want any of this. Are you listening to me?
When the whole world's gone ad.
Oh, we're listening.
Thank goodness there's Gruen. Wednesday nights on ABC TV and always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
Time to head to the Weather Bureau. Our forecaster today is Jenny Horvat. Hello, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Is there much going on weather-wise? It's been pretty steady as she goes the last few weeks, really.
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to continue that way as we head into the weekend. So we've had one high-pressure system move out into the Tasman Sea, but that's being replaced pretty quickly by another high-pressure system currently situated south of WA. So between the two of them, maintaining a ridge of high pressure across the state. We did see some fog patches around this morning. We saw those visibilities reduced at the Waiala Airport, likewise and Kangaroo Island and down in the southeast as well. A little bit of fog around this morning. And it was a little bit chilly in parts, some of those temperatures getting close to zero. Cootawarra saw a minimum temperature this morning of 0.2 degrees. 1 degree was recorded at Robe Airfield, Narracourt, just above a degree. Yunta and Remark, all about a degree and a half this morning. So it was a little bit of a chilly start, but we are expecting temperatures today for maximum to remain above average in the west and south and pretty close to average about the north today. Not too much cloud around looking at the satellite picture, but we have seen a little bit of high cloud drifting across from the WA border, but it is generally mostly sunny skies throughout for today. So dry conditions continuing for today. We will see a cold front move over Tasmania tomorrow, so the tail end of that may bring a little bit of light shower activity around the far southeast tomorrow, but we're not expecting anything too significant as that all moves through. Again, looking at probably a bit of a cold start in parts, so maybe some localised frost patches across northern parts of the agricultural area Friday morning. Again, could see some fog around Eyre Peninsula and the southeast again on Friday morning. As we head into the weekend, that high pressure system will come a little bit closer. So again, it's expecting to see some chilly mornings and maybe some fog patches around as we head into the weekend. That high coming closer will maintain a bit more of a southerly airstream. So looking at seeing some of those maximum temperatures coming down as well. And as we head into Sunday with that southerly airstream, maybe starting to see a little bit of shower activity developing on the Sunday there, and probably mostly around those southern coastal districts. As we head into Monday, we could see those light showers maybe pushing more broadly into the agricultural area, but still more likely around the southern coast as that sort of southerly air pushes up. Not expecting too much rainfall with that, and again, remaining pretty dry and mostly sunny in the north. As we head into the early part of next week, we will really see those showers contracting to the coast and clearing by midweek, and again some of those cool mornings persisting away from the cloud inland, so looking at some cold mornings, especially Sunday morning is looking pretty cold, so likely to see some areas of frost on the Sunday and to a lesser extent early in the week through there. So having a bit of a look at our rainfall, so maybe, like I said, on the Friday, a little bit moving through the southeast there, probably dry conditions again on the Saturday and maybe starting to see a little bit of light shower activity in the onshore, but we're really not looking at too much as far as totals go. Generally less than a millimetre about the southern agricultural area by the end of Monday, and maybe a little bit more about our southern coasts and ranges, but only really 2 or 3 millimetres at best, Selena. It's still looking like quite a dry pattern for the forecast period.
All right. Thanks, Jenny. Enjoy the rest of your day.
No worries. Thanks, Selena.
Jenny Horvat there from the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the weather for the western inland parts of New South Wales. For the upper western district tomorrow, partly cloudy with a medium chance of showers in the northeast from the late morning, near zero chance of rain elsewhere, and there is a chance of a thunderstorm. Overnight, it'll get to between 10 and 14 degrees during the day into the low to mid-20s. For the lower western district, there is a chance of fog early in the morning, but a sunny day to follow with overnight temperatures between 5 and 8 degrees. In the day, it should climb into the low 20s as well. Coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour, in this next half an hour, an update on what's going on with the fruit fly outbreak north of Adelaide and what it means for producers in that area.
listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Now, have you noticed less plastic waste in the fruit and veg section of your supermarket these days? I think there's been quite a shift in thinking about this, and a lot of it has been driven by consumers. Well, one change you'll see is from Australia's second largest supermarket chain, and it's replacing net bags with paper bags for mandarins.
It's in response to a real community concern. I mean, I know when Coles surveys their customers, plastics and packaging are really at the top of their lists of concerns. So they are, in fact, responding to what their customers are telling them. There's always room for improvement, as we know. And the message is really to avoid unnecessary packaging.
There's more to come on that story. But where else in the produce section can you see room for improvement? Are there other ways you think that fruit and veg is packaged that you reckon could be less wasteful? Let me know on my talkback number today, 1300 222 891. Or text me your thoughts to 0467 922 891. Also coming up, there's an update on the fruit fly outbreak north of Adelaide and the impact that it's having on the movement of fresh fruit and veg in and out of that very important food bowl. But first, to Matt Coleman with headlines. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the state government has announced a new curriculum for public schools across the state, with the first four subjects of the South Australian Curriculum for Public Education to be taught from next year. The new and adapted curriculum will have a focus on English, maths, language and arts. Under the change, a greater focus will be put on encouraging students to read more, decluttering the curriculum, learning about resilience and empathy, as well as art creation to improve students' skills and techniques. The state's unemployment rate for April rose to 4.2%, the equal highest of any jurisdiction in the country. It was up 0.3 of a percentage point on the March result. The national unemployment rate last month also increased by 0.2 of a percentage point to 4.1. And a 47-year-old Gillis Plains man driving erratically around the outskirts of the Adelaide CBD last night was arrested by police. Police say they spotted a Ford Falcon speeding and travelling on the wrong side of the road just before 3:30. Patrols lost the car, but they managed to locate a stop near Ayres House. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, a Riverland wine grape grower and contract harvester pretty worried about the collapse of the region as growers struggle to pay their bills amid an industry crisis. For almost two decades, Maria Cialis has run contracting businesses in the region. She's recently told her adult children there's no future in the family business for them. And she says it's gut-wrenching that the struggling industry was overlooked for assistance in the federal budget, which was handed down this week.
It's gut-wrenching. It really, really is, because it's not a small community. It's not just the Riverland. It's Australia-wide that we're having this issue. And, you know, the cliche, the man on the land, yeah, if the man on the land doesn't do well, no one does well. And we already can see it here in Renmark, you know. No one has money to spend. No one is going out to restaurants to spend their money. No one's coming into shops. No one's buying tractors. No one is doing anything. So if they don't have the money, well, then how are these small communities going to survive? We don't want to see the Riverland become ghost towns. You know, we want to see our shops open. We don't want to see them close. We want to see young people coming back into the region. And we were seeing that even in my, you know, in our community here. I was seeing young people that had left Renmark, went to Adelaide for further education or for a different job, whatever. They've got married, they've had children, they've decided to come back to Renmark to raise their children here like they were, which was such a great sign just to see that. Well, that's all going to disappear again. You know, all of those people are probably second-guessing themselves for coming back. I've got children myself in their mid-20s. And, you know, they left the region to educate themselves and, you know, because of work. They've actually come back the last 8 months, which ideally for me and my husband was excellent, and that helped us with the family business, having the kids back. But, you know, we've had to have that hard discussion with them that it's not liable. We can't afford all of us to be in the family business. We're you know, 8 years ago, we could. We can't do it anymore. So they're moving. They're moving back to Adelaide, which is sad because we need the young generation here.
So you're, I mean, that's everyone's dream, really, and you hear it less and less of the children of people in working in agriculture coming back and wanting to work in the family business, but you've sort of talked with your children about it just not being viable. How did they feel about that?
They were disappointed because, you know, they love Remark. They love the community. They love being, you know, seeing friends that they grew up with, being involved with, you know, the soccer clubs and just all that in general. They just love that community spirit. And for them to say that we have to go back to the big smoke, you know, it was hard. They stuck it out for, you know, 8 months and seen what we've gone through. And, it's just not affordable. They just can't afford to stay here. So they'll be moving back to the city and, you know, doing what they have to do. But like I said, one of my children married, the other one's not. But, you know, thinking the next 5-10 years, you know, bigger family, grandchildren, we won't see that here in the Riverland. And I don't think I'm the only one. I think there's going to be a lot of people the same. And even me, in my, you know, at my age, we're even thinking, where are we going to be in the next 5 years? What are we going to do in the next 5 years? So, yeah, there's big questions. There's no answers. And like you said, the federal government hasn't decided to help the wine industry. And yes, people may say it's a luxury and not a necessity, but guess what? We've had this luxury for millions of years. You know, they even used to use wine for medicinal purposes. So we've got that infrastructure here. And if that fades and you see vineyards getting pulled out, we'll just have a bull dust here. That's it. It's going to be just empty land and nothing else.
And you've already made changes to your business in the last few years. You said you dropped back from 4 harvests to 3. Are you looking at future changes?
Yes, definitely, we are. And we've tried to diversify with other businesses. Like, you know, we've got the vineyard, we became contractors, and it's not just the picking. Now we're supposed to be pruning for growers. So it's a vicious circle. It's not just the picking. So now, you know, we've got that infrastructure again. We've got 4 pruners that we've invested money into. They're supposed to be pruning from next week. Usually we prune from next week until start of September. We've had to do the hard questions and ring our growers where it was just an automatic, we're pruning. Now we've had to ring them and say, you know, what are we doing? What are you thinking? Are you going to continue growing your grapes? Are we going to come and prune it for you? Some of them don't have the answers yet. They're all confused, which is hard, and we can't give them the answers. That has to be something that they have to decide. And again, financially, we've invested in those 4 pruners. If we do go and prune for someone, are we going to get paid? We don't know.
Is there anything that federal and state governments can do or that you want them to know about the situation here in the Riverland and for the wine industry?
Yes, they need to start listening. I think we've had enough information out there. We've had enough meetings. Even the last meeting we had in Barmer, there was so much information. Unfortunately, in the end, they told us we had the wrong people there, which, again, that was a blow. You know, if we're going to have these meetings, let's have the right people there. They need to listen. They're going to lose the country communities. And it's not only about the people in the city. We're all one. They need to listen to what we need. They need to give us a hand. You know, if it's something, you know, that I think they need to have 3 different outcomes. One is who wants to leave, whatever the circumstances, they're getting older or they've got a small vineyard, they don't want to run it anymore. Give them an out, give them something for them to say, okay, I'm going to vine pool, this is what I'm going to get per acre, and be reasonable with what they're going to give them. Then you're going to have the people that love what they're doing and want to still stay in the industry, like me. I love living in the middle of a vineyard. I've been doing that since I was a baby. But help us. If you can see that, you know, we're not making the money to grow the grapes, then tell us, hey, you know, for the next 3 years, don't grow it, but we will give you something in return. Pay us what we should be getting, and then we won't have the glut. I think it's not just a circumstance one fits for all. I think there is different ways of going around it. And like we were discussing before, you know, we can afford to help our foreign help and send money overseas and stuff, which is great. You know, when people need help, of course, that's what we're going to do. But let's look at what people need here in Australia first. And we all need that help so that they can't just put their blindfolds on and say, hey, they're going to go away. We're not going to go away because, you know, we've all invested in our vineyards. It's where we live. And some people like myself, my house is right in the middle of my vineyard. It's not as if I can subdivide it and think, okay, I'm going to sell this as land or sell my house or whatever. We can't do that either. So I think it's time that the government listens to the smaller people because we may be small, but we make a big impact.
That is Maria Cialis, who's a wine grape grower and contractor from Riverland Barrel Pruners and Harvesting, speaking there to Eliza Berlage. The Federal Minister for Agriculture, Murray Watt, was contacted for an interview, but a federal government spokesperson said in a statement that the budget provided several measures for the wine industry, including $2 million to re-establish commercial connections in China for ag exporters, $487.9 million in the next few years for Austrade's export market development program as well. Hello to Farmer Annie, who's at Victor and who's hopped on the text line. And he says, I was involved in the vine pool in the 1980s. And he says, people planted far too many vines since then. And now there is an oversupply. No one bails out sheep farmers or barley farmers when our prices fall, says Annie. It is 19 minutes to one. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. Well, there is an ongoing fruit fly outbreak north of Adelaide that's making extra work for those growing fruit and veg in the Virginia area. It means extra steps have to be taken moving and selling produce from that food bowl before it can get to your supermarket shelf. So how widespread is this outbreak currently and is it likely to end anytime soon? I asked the General Manager of PERS's Fruit Fly Emergency Response, Con Poulos, for an update on the situation.
So the outbreak was declared on the 5th of March in Salisbury North, and that was due to us detecting 6 flies over a 2-week period. So that was enough for a trigger to declare an outbreak. Since then, we started our operations the same day. So we have an operations crew in Adelaide that baits the Red Centre and the outbreak area, which is the 1.5 area around the detections. There's around 40 people in that response. And unfortunately, this outbreak meant the boundary extended out to the Northern Adelaide Plains and took in some of that vegetable production area that we all know really well.
So since that time, have there been any sort of further fruit flies turn up or any extra detections?
Very low numbers, and when I say low, like literally we found one extra fly in that outbreak area in the last month, so the detections have really slowed down, but the outbreak scenario remains in place until later this year. So currently the reinstatement date is the 13th of November, but if we find further flies, that can extend out.
Yeah, so what is the process that needs to be no further detections for a certain amount of time before those restrictions can be lifted?
Yeah, that's right. So once detections get down to zero, then we have a period of time, and once we get to the reinstatement date, we can lift the restrictions on fruit movement, particularly out there, again, out in the Northern Adelaide Plains, which is important for the commercial producers out there.
Absolutely. So a lot of producers in that area, what does this mean for them and the restrictions and rules that they have to follow to move their produce in and out of that zone?
Yeah, so we have secure movement restrictions. So the meeting today, which we're having at 4:30 out at the Virginia Community Centre, we're going to go through some of those restrictions and the supports available to growers out there. One of the key priorities for PERS obviously is eradicating fruit fly, but another priority is allowing fruit movement with commercial growers. We need the economy to function. We still want all that beautiful produce that's grown to get back into Metro Adelaide and other areas. So there's certain treatments and certain assurance programs that we work through with growers that will allow that movement and satisfy the secure movement as well.
So that includes things like fumigation of certain produce?
Yeah, fumigation is one of the treatments. And we've got a fumigator set up at the produce markets in Adelaide. But there's also other things the growers can do, which is around baiting and having traps on their property, checking their fruit, doing hygiene checks. So there's other avenues for secure fruit movement as well into sensitive markets. When I say sensitive markets, I mean back into South Australia, places like WA, Tassie. But growers also can move their fruit and vegetables quite freely through to the eastern states. But again, there are some restrictions around secure movement when you move it through the state.
This is obviously an impost for those producers. What about the general public? Obviously, I'm sure producers are doing everything they can to sort of, you know, get this these restrictions lifted and the fruit fly out. But what about general members of the public moving through that area?
Yeah, you're right. So we work very closely with industry, and this isn't the first meeting we're having out there. So we meet regularly and speak to industry regularly. But look, general public, please check the fruitslope.sa.gov.au website. All the maps are there. So people who are in the suspension areas and in the outbreak areas, there are restrictions in fruit. So basically, if you're in the red zone, it's illegal to move fruit off your property. If you're in a yellow zone, you can move fruit, but it has to stay in the yellow zone. If you can't come out to a green zone, it can't go into a red zone. So without boring everybody on the radio, the details are really well explained on our website. And as always, if people see anything suspect at home, please ring our hotline. It's 1300 666 010, and our team will be there to assist you.
And can you just remind us, you know, for those who might be wondering, well, what's all the fuss about? You know, why do we put such restrictions in place because a few fruit flies have been detected? I mean, what's the possible consequences of this outbreak extending?
When an outbreak is declared, we follow national and international protocols. So we put in these fruit movement restriction areas. But look, it's important that fruit fly will travel mainly by people moving it inadvertently with fruit and veggies. So putting these restrictions in place is critical so we don't accidentally spread these fruit flies across the state and into other areas. So they're there for a reason. They're not anything new. Every time we've had an outbreak in South Australia, we've followed the same protocols. We've got systems in place and we've had great success in eradicating them previously.
As part of this process, have you been looking into where those original six fruit flies may have come from? Are there any answers as to how they got into South Australia, into that Salisbury area?
Look, it's not clear yet. Look, when we first started detecting them there, yes, we went and door knocked. We had a look at the area where the flies were detected. There's no clear pathway, but as I said, fruit flies will mainly move with people, so that's why fruit and veg movement restrictions are really critical when we do our eradication processes.
That's the General Manager of PERS's Fruit Fly Emergency Response, Con Poulos there. There's an agent, and grower workshop being held at the Virginia Community Centre. That's at 4:30 this afternoon. It will include folks from PERS. There'll be folks there from the Family and Business Mentoring Program and Rural Business Support as well. So you can find the details for that on PERS's social media channels. And don't forget, you can go to their website if you want more details on where those fruit fly restrictions apply.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And you are with Selena Green this afternoon. And do you ever buy your produce in plastic net bags? Australia's second largest supermarket chain is replacing those plastic net bags with paper ones for its mandarins this season, and that is in a bid to reduce plastic waste. Coles says the new 100% recyclable packaging will avoid the use of almost 12,000 kilograms of plastic in 1 year. But packing companies say they embrace sustainable packaging way ahead of the supermarkets. Fabio Spinello is a grower liaison officer for Venus Citrus in South Australia's Riverland.
Yeah, we've been marketing recyclable packaging for probably half a dozen years or so. Helen and Maria, that lead our marketing team, have sort of gone down that path. You know, we're going into sustainability growing, and we've also got growers that grow. We have an eco brand, so there's definitely chemicals that aren't used on that citrus, and they're packaged in that way as well. And it's been quite successful for us, not just here in Australia, but we have exported quantities overseas as well. Obviously, it's a higher demand or price return for that fruit, but it's been a slow road, but it's improving all the time.
Talk me through your recyclable packaging options. So what packaging do you have, and what's this recycling packaging look like and involve?
Well, we used to always use plastic trays and plastic sleeves over the trays. We've gone to cardboard trays. They are more dearer, but in the long run it's better for the environment and better for everybody in turn. And even our plasticky type shrouds over the containers, they're recyclable as well. So yeah, it looks good, it's better. It is a little bit more costly, but we're trying to do the right thing by the environment, and we're improving all the time. The product's improving all the time, and we'll keep going.
And was this move to more recyclable packaging, was that driven by Venus Citrus, or was that something pushed for by your supermarkets and people you supply to, or a bit of both?
Well, we definitely pushed this well before the supermarkets approached us about it anyway, before we started supplying them. So we've been doing it for a fair while. I'd say with our eco brand, which has been up and running for probably a good dozen years or so. So we were already in that process of going down that path. So it's been a good dozen plus years for us.
And the net bag is something that people have often associated with citrus. I mean, you can get avocados and other onions in it too, but citrus in the net bag is something I've always thought about. But I've heard that's kind of disappearing.
Oh, not really, not with us. We do a very large program with mandarins and even oranges in the net bag. And we run a couple of different types of bags, right up to a high-grade piece of fruit at a certain dollar value, and then to a class two or so piece of fruit at a lesser value, which we use different bags for. So for us, we use a Venus Black bag that has the premium fruit or premier fruit in it. And then we have a sweet and juicy bag that has the lesser grade fruit in it, a bit more marked and blemished. But as we all know, citrus is, doesn't matter if it's marked and blemished on the outside, the inside's just as sweet as a perfect piece of fruit on the outside. We also, our class two trays, we actually tell a bit of a story. We have a cardboard recyclable tray that is marketed as Kissed by Nature, so we use that as a class two, and instead of just using a plain black box, and that's been received in the market sensationally over the last couple of years. You know, it just keeps improving.
Yeah, that brand has been really interesting because, yeah, you're right, like food waste, as much as some consumers can be picky, consumers really don't want to see food waste, so people have been quite responsive in buying this Kissed by Nature product.
For sure, and I think when you start to explain to consumers what's going on and make them aware, obviously we're able to move more product that way. So yeah, we've just got to educate everybody and tell them it's a good piece of fruit.
And lastly, just on your packaging, where were your net bags being made and where are your current new recyclable packaging being made?
Our net bags are made interstate, and our all our cardboard packaging and stuff like that, all our boxes and everything are made locally, like through Visiboard.
Venus Citrus Grower Liaison Officer Fabio Spignello. Planet Ark Chief Executive Rebecca Gilling says plastic isn't necessarily the enemy, as paper can have a large footprint. But, she says, reducing unnecessary packaging in the first place is key.
Plastics is obviously an issue that is really top of mind for many consumers and householders. But I think one of the distinctions that needs to be made is about plastic per se and plastic pollution. I think what concerns people is when plastic escapes into the environment. Also, I think when we lose plastic to landfill, we're obviously losing a valuable material. At the moment, of course, we don't have a widespread recycling solution for soft plastics, which we had previously on a fairly small scale. But without that, then there is no solution for those soft plastics in the main for most people, except going into landfill. So we do have a lost resource there. But the key thing is to keep them out of the environment. So reducing their use in the first instance is obviously a very good thing. In terms of its comparative footprint, if you like, there is quite a lot of research done on life cycle analyses of paper versus plastic. And, you know, there are a great many variables involved here. But I think what people don't understand is that in many ways, paper has a bigger footprint. It has a bigger land footprint. It has a bigger water footprint. And what its carbon footprint is dependent on its source and where it ends up.
That's a really interesting point, that while plastics, if they do end up in the environment, can be quite detrimental, yeah, producing paper and the footprint of paper is quite big. You know, what are some of the things that people need to remember with paper?
Well, let's take it back a step. Let's not demonise plastics across the board. Plastic is an incredibly valuable material. It's durable, it's flexible, it can be used in a great many different applications. What we need to do, however, is to keep it in circulation. There are something like, I think, 8.4 billion tonnes of plastic in the world today, which is more than enough for our uses. What we need to do is capture that plastic and reuse it in the many applications for which it is well designed. Unfortunately, what's happened in people's concerns about plastic is that in many applications, they've switched from PET plastic to paper and then try to get paper to do the things that plastic does naturally by lining it with, in many cases, with things like PFAS, which is its own, you know, has its own set of problems attached to it. That PFAS lining does the grease and provides the grease and moisture barrier that the plastic does naturally. So in the broad, to think that we just switch out plastic and replace it with paper has unintended consequences. In the case of the coal situation that we're talking about here, we're obviously replacing something that is not currently recyclable with something that absolutely is recyclable. So in that sense, it's a really good move because it's reducing the amount of waste that is going to landfill, and that waste, as we know, represents lost value.
With plastics, Australians only sort of really recycle maybe about 16% of plastics.
That's right. It's a very low recycling rate.
So I've talked to some local packing sheds here, and they say they've been looking at more recyclable packaging for quite a number of years, and they feel that they've been leading the charge rather than the supermarkets. Is that something that, you know, Planet Ark, do you think supermarkets are doing enough to reduce packaging overall, especially maybe packaging that's in excess?
Well, I think that, yes, across the board, they are doing what they can to reduce the amount of packaging they're putting on the market. And I agree that the brand owners are really doing their bit very much as well. It's in response to real community concern. I mean, when Coles surveys their customers, plastics and packaging are really at the top of their lists of concerns. So they are, in fact, responding to what their customers are telling them. So I think, look, yes, they are. There's always room for improvement, as we know. And the message from Planet Ark is really to avoid unnecessary packaging, bearing in mind that plastic has a role to play, particularly in the area of avoiding food waste. Plastic is great for keeping food fresh, but we don't need, for example, to put our bananas in a plastic bag because they've already got their own packaging that does a very good job of keeping it fresh and protected. So from the consumer's point of view, we need to think about what is necessary packaging and what is unnecessary packaging, and vote with our purses. And as we can see, the supermarkets and the brand owners are alert to that and respond.
That is the Chief Executive of Planet Ark, Rebecca Gilling, and she was ending that story from Eliza Berlage. And if you'd like to read more and see a video of some of the bags being made, hop on to the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural, because Eliza's got a great story up there right now. Bill on the text line suggests maybe the paper for packaging could be made using hemp, as it needs little water. And hello also to the text who sent me a photo of a bag of carrots from Coles. It says, stamped on the bag, this bag is 100% recyclable through your local Coles. Our text says, very annoying. It's untrue. I've seen this on carrots and apples as well. It's 1:02. Hello to Nikolai Balhartz. Hello.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm all right. What have you got coming for us today?
Well, I think there's been a lot of close examination of the federal budget, and rightfully so, because obviously it has a whole lot of different ramifications. But there are more details coming through as part of it. And one that I don't think has received a whole lot of attention so far is that the bowel cancer screening kit, that's now available to people who are a little bit younger. So it used to be, you used to have to be 50. Now, if you're between 45 and 49, you can request a kit to get tested if you want to. So we'll take a look at what the reasoning is behind that. Obviously, early intervention is probably one of the significant parts of that. But it's just an interesting part of the budget. So we'll take a look at that. Also, joining us in the studio this afternoon, the South Australian Police Commissioner, Grant Stevens, to find out, try and bring some of the names and faces and voices that you know very well and try and find out a little bit more about them. And amongst the, there's a lot to talk about with the commissioner, as you can imagine. But when he was young, throughout his schooling, he said, well, I wasn't nothing inspirational. I wasn't very motivated. I didn't apply myself very well. And now he's where he is today.
Look at me now.
I know. It's all...
I wonder what his teachers thought of that.
I know.
In that role.
Exactly. So we'll find out more about that journey, dare I say that word, this afternoon.
Oh, we love a journey.
Yeah, I know.
Going on a journey with Nikolai Balhartz for afternoons. Stick around for that. Thanks so much for your company today. And I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour. It's news time.
Lend us your ears and make life easier by using the ABC Listen app in the car. It will automatically quieten when you get calls or navigation instructions. Just make sure you favourite your local ABC radio station.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.